Thank you very much for the introduction. It was great to hear Tony's speech and to follow him on the platform, a real privilege. He used the words unprecedented opportunity. My PowerPoint could be put back to the beginning. You'll see that I say seize the moment. It's the same thing. Before I go into the presentation, though, there's just a few things I want to say. I thought this was amazing. I was really pleased to learn the American for this. Apparently it's called a flash drive. In the British government we call it a security risk. That's it, perfect, thank you. Anyway, I'm going to treasure this and represent the 21st century, as Paul said. The other thing, by the way, is that represents the 21st century. You know the London Underground, the London Tube, or Metro, it was invented in 1870, and until the year 2000, the most commonly lost item on the London Underground was an umbrella. And in the year 2000, it was overtaken by, guess what, the cell phone. So it's a perfect shift from one century to the next. The reason I chose this title, Seize the Moment, and by the way, I apologise for my cold. If I lose my voice, I'll stop doing sign language. But the reason I chose this title is, as exactly as Tony has just said, this is a remarkable moment for American public education. I really think that this year, next year, the year after, there's a moment to be seized. Why do I think that? Well, first of all, again as Tony said, you have a remarkable president. It's very unusual to have a president, or indeed a leader of any country, who can look teenagers in the eye and say, if you drop out, you're not just letting yourself down, you're letting down America. You've also got the opportunity to learn from NCLB, which in my view was a step forward, and build on it with the reauthorization that Tony's just been talking about. You've also got the money in the stimulus package, and especially the Race to the Top Fund. You've also got a thoughtful agenda that Tony's just taken you through, the four elements in the four assurances. You've also got, right around the country, demonstration sites like New York City, like Louisiana, like Chicago, where many of the reforms that are needed are being proven in terms of the outcomes they're delivering. You've also got a range of not-for-profit organisations like Teach for America, like some of the charter operators, who are demonstrating again and again that they can replicate these things that matter and take them to scale. And then you've got the foundations like Gates and Broad and others willing to invest in taking public education forward. Put all that together and then add to the fact that actually there is a very broad shared agenda among American educators. And this is a remarkable opportunity. My favourite historian, I studied history at university, is a British historian called G.M. Trevelyan, who wrote books in the late 19th and early 20th century, when people liked long sentences with many sub-clauses. It was before the soundbite had been invented. And this was his equivalent of a soundbite. Writing about Garibaldi, he said, "There come rare moments, hard to distinguish, but fatal to let slip when all must be set upon a hazard." That is this moment in American education. The other thing to say about this is you've got this moment at the same time as the rest of the world is learning about whole system reform. You know, in the 1980s, there were the path-breaking school effectiveness studies when we learned what an effective school looks like. People like my colleagues in the Institute of Education, Peter Mortimer in England, but many people here in this country too. And then in the 1990s, we had another wave of research which said, well, we know what an effective school looks like now, but how do you become effective? And that was what we called the school improvement research. So we went from school effectiveness to school improvement. And then in this decade, we've been defining what an effective system looks like. We're able to do that because of the PISA and the TIMSS and the other international comparisons. So we know a lot about what an effective system looks like. And the study that we did called How the World's Best Performing School Systems Come Out on Top was part of taking that debate forward. But now the issue is not what does a good system look like, but how do you become a good system? So we're having gone from school effectiveness to school improvement, we're now going from system effectiveness to system improvement. And your opportunity is an opportunity all around the world, because we know a lot about what an effective system needs to do, what a system needs to do to become effective. And your opportunity, this moment which can be seized now, you can learn from that, as the administration is consciously doing, to take your system to a new level. So this is a remarkable moment. And I want to, in my remark, embed your opportunity in the global landscape. Let's start with a few facts and figures. I was born in 1955. There were 2.5 billion people on the planet the day I was born. If I lived to be 100, God forbid, there will be 9 billion people on the planet. That is a very crowded planet, with pressure on the resources, with demands on each of us to add enough value to the global economy to generate wealth that will enable 9 billion people to lead fulfilled lives. It's a huge challenge. There will be 26 cities with more than 10 million people living on them by 2020. Those cities will be very diverse. If you go to Toronto, you'll find that 57% of the population was born outside of Canada. If you come to London, you'll find that 33% of our workforce was born outside the United Kingdom. So these 26 global cities, and there are hundreds and hundreds between 5 million and 10 million, these cities are going to be interesting, challenging, creative, fascinating places, generating ideas, thinking, innovation. They're going to be the hub of the global economy. This is the first decade in human history when more than half the population of the globe lived in cities. That happened in 1920 in America. It became 50% in cities. It happened in 1851 in England. But now it's the global challenge. So how well our cities function is going to be really important. And one of the things about the cities is they're hugely diverse in religion, in race, in attitude, in age, in lifestyle, in aspiration. So we can either make those cities function really well, in which case they'll be the creative hub of the next great wave of innovation, or we can get it wrong, in which case they'll be full of tension, conflict. What institution is going to do most to make sure those cities are successful? The answer is the public school. It's the only institution we can rely on to make those cities effective. By the way, some of those cities are growing very fast. This is the number of people who will be added to the shanty towns of Delhi in the next 12 months. There are 11 million children in India who are street children. In England, we have 7 million children in our entire school system. In India, there are 11 million street children. In Pakistan, where the total population is 169 million, there are 100 million people under the age of 25. 50 million of them, half of them, have never ever been to school. Those that do go to school, after 3 years, 40% of them can't do single-digit subtraction. When I talk about the 26 cities, they include Karachi, they include Lahore and Delhi and Mumbai. So education reform is not just needed in this country or my country, it's needed around the world if we're to make the world a fulfilling place to live. Then take this, here's an interesting statistic. If you take all the economic growth from the day the pyramids were built, whenever that was, several thousand years ago, to the 1950s, when America built its interstate highways. Add up all that economic, that is a lot of economic growth. That includes all the medieval cathedrals, all those clipper ships saving tea from India to the United Kingdom, and everything. Add it all up, $7 trillion. We're going to create that much again in the next 14 years. Now we can do that in two ways. We can do it in the way we did it in the 20th century, in which case we will waste the entire resources of the planet, we'll destroy its wildernesses, and we will find that the 9 billion people are living in a desert. Or we can do it creatively, innovatively, differently, without waste, productively, and those 9 billion people can live fulfilled lives. How are we going to have people who can do that? The answer is we're going to educate them better than we've ever done before. In this country, in my country, in India and Pakistan and China and everywhere else. We have to do this, colleagues, if we're going to create that growth to fulfill the lives of 9 billion people without destroying the planet. And then there's this. If you add up the change in the temperature on the planet since 1750 to now. It's roughly 0.8 degrees Celsius. Now, if you go right back to the Ice Age, you can find undulations where 0.8 degrees Celsius happens over a few hundred years. You can find that. But right now, unless we do something really drastic, the temperature on the planet in the next 100 years will rise by 3 degrees, and that has never happened, ever. If they make an agreement in Copenhagen in December, they might, if everybody has the will behind it, reduce the growth in the temperature of the planet to 2 degrees. That never happened either. That is a huge challenge, colleagues. How are we going to have a population that can manage the energy resources, or as President Obama said at the G20 summit in March, where are we going to find the people who are going to invent the technologies that mean we can control climate change? We're going to find them in our public schools, in America, in England, in India, in Pakistan, in China, and everywhere else. So climate change depends on education too. And let me just finish with this. If you look at the number of species on the planet and their rate of extinction, since 1750, the rate of extinction of species has multiplied by 1,000 times. So one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, do we want to share the planet just with the 9 billion human beings, or would we like there to be some other living things on this planet? Personally, I know what I want, but we have to manage that. You know, when Theodore Roosevelt started saving the national parks for the United States 100 years ago, he was onto something there, because he realised that after the frontier had closed in the 1890s, you had to manage the wildernesses, otherwise the natural forms of economic growth would destroy them. So he saved Yosemite and countless other national parks. And how far-sighted that looks now. Who is the Theodore Roosevelt for the planet now? We're destroying the Himalayan wildernesses. We're destroying the rainforest. Look what's happening to Antarctica. These are huge issues. You could have a wilderness in places where people lived and not worry about it in the 1800s. But right now, if you want a wilderness in 50 years, you have to preserve it. You have to make a decision to look after it as a global group of people. Again, education is really important. So this is a big issue. This is not just about equity in American schools. Very important though that is. It's about the future of life on Earth. Now, if that's the challenge, the question for education reform is not just about the four assurances or other things. The first thing we have to decide is, what would we like students to know, understand, and be able to do in, say, 2020 or 25? They're having a debate about this in Alberta. In Australia, they're writing the first ever Australian national curriculum. Until now, it's been each of the states separately. So people are debating this all around the world. I tried to summarise what I think it should be, but I'm only guessing. I'm sort of working towards it. We're all working towards it. But what does it look like? Well, I wanted to summarise what I think in a mathematical equation to make it easy for you to remember. That is, for those of you who like maths, or math, as you would call it. And here it is. So let's start inside the bracket. There's a debate, isn't there, in the education area about whether children need to learn knowledge. After all, you can store a lot of knowledge on a flash drive. Personally, I think this debate is absolutely absurd. Children clearly need to learn some knowledge, and that's what the K stands for. They need to learn how to read and write well. They need to know really well how to do the basic elements of mathematics. They need to learn some science. They need to study the history of their own country and get some sense of the shape of the world and the nature of the world they live in and their place in it. So knowledge is really important, but it's by no means the whole story. So knowledge, definitely. But then, what about the T? Well, the thing about knowledge, you know that saying, knowledge is power? It isn't really true. Knowledge on its own isn't power at all. You can't do anything with knowledge unless you can do things with the knowledge. And doing things with knowledge is what we call thinking, which is what the T stands for. If you've got knowledge and you can connect pieces of it, if you've got knowledge and you can generate new knowledge by combining elements of knowledge, that's what we call thinking, then you're really onto something. So knowledge plus thinking, that needs to be in the curriculum. Now, we don't want whole swathes of lessons separate from the rest of the curriculum called thinking skills. What we want is teachers, highly qualified, highly effective teachers, who can teach the thinking through the curriculum. who can say, when they're teaching a piece of science, look how we thought about that. Look what we mean by evidence in science and how it's different from history when we use the word evidence in science. We want that kind of teaching. So knowledge plus thinking. When I was a young teacher in 1979, I was teaching in a suburb north of London called Watford. And I noticed a boy at the back of my class looking out the window, which actually in Watford is very unusual because there's nothing to see. So I say to him, what are you doing? He says, I'm thinking. And I say, well, stop it and get on with your work. I got it all wrong, didn't I? He needed to be thinking. He was doing the right thing. Knowledge plus thought. But knowledge plus thought isn't power either, colleagues. Knowledge plus thought is just the start. How many times have you been in a meeting? You go along to a meeting where some decisions are being made in your workplace, for example, and on the way out of the meeting, you're walking away with a friend, and the friend says, I didn't agree with any of that. And you say, why didn't you say so? And they say, I didn't think it was the right time. What they mean is, they didn't have the confidence to intervene at the point of decision. So you can have the knowledge and have done the thinking, but if you don't intervene, if you don't have the confidence to intervene at the point of decision, you have no influence, no power. So we need knowledge plus thought plus L for leadership. Here I don't mean leading a big organisation, I mean being able to lead at a given moment in a meeting, in your family, in your workplace, in your community, in your school. The opportunity to seize the moment, to have the confidence to put the knowledge, the thought, and the intervention all together. And you know, it's not just the wildernesses that is extending the range of decisions. Think about genetic engineering. We all have to make decisions about these things. We all have to make decisions. They're complicated, they're difficult. And what's more, the pace of decision making is speeding up. We don't even notice it. But I tell you, the pace of decision making is completely different from 80 years ago. My first book, which I don't recommend, was The History of the Teacher Unions in England. I went to the National Union of Teachers and I said to the librarian there, I would like to see what the National Union of Teachers said about the Haddo Report of 1926. The Haddo Report was the report that decided schools in elementary schools should be divided at age 11 into primary and secondary departments. And eventually the secondary departments became our secondary schools, which is why we have the break at 11. So it's a very important report. So I go to the librarian and she says, I'll check the archives. And she comes back a day later and she says, they didn't respond. And I said, that's impossible. The most important report between the First World War and the Second World War and the biggest teacher union, it must have said something. She said, I'll go and look again. She comes back. She says, they did respond to the Haddo report of 1926 in 1928. They thought that was normal. And the Haddo report, as I say, proposed the division of schools at the age of 11. Do you know when the last all-age elementary school was closed down in England? It was in 1971. So you've got a report in 1926, a two-year consultation phase, and a 45-year implementation phase. That was slow decision making, but it was normal then. It's not normal now. The pace of decision is speeding up. So if we want all of our citizens, all those 9 billion people, to have the knowledge and the thinking, we also want them to be able to intervene when it matters at the point of decision. We want them to have leadership skills. We want them to have confidence in themselves, an ability to persuade, an ability to listen, an ability to argue, an ability to work with other people, an ability to say, I want my wilderness. I don't want my world destroyed. I want this, I want that. But I want it because I want it for the whole of humanity. And that leads to the E. Because you could have knowledge and thought and leadership and put it all together and be very powerful, but you could use that power for evil purposes. We saw a lot of that in the 20th century. We don't want to see a lot of it in the 21st century because we will destroy humanity if we do. So the E stands for ethical underpinning. This is difficult territory for public education. But unless our children grow up with some sense of the ethics that will make the 21st century possible, we have a real problem facing us. Take those cities again. Our children need to learn in those cities how to get on with people from very, very diverse backgrounds, very diverse religions, people who they're going to profoundly disagree with in their view of the world. But to make the cities work, they've got to learn to get on with them. That is an ethical question. The only place they're going to learn that is in our schools. That's just one of many ethical questions. Genetic engineering, I mentioned. All the things to do with peace war and conflict, all the things to do with wealth and poverty around the world, within one country and across the planet, all the things to do with the other species on the planet, the rainforests, whatever it might be. These are complicated ethical questions. Now, if you went back 100 years in America, you would find that most children got their ethical upbringing from three sources: the school, the church, and their family. And they would have found that those three ethical sources were broadly coming from the same direction. So they got an ethical upbringing with a set of common values. And we can say, when we look back on some of those values, we wish they'd been different. For example, in attitudes to race. But nevertheless, there were three sources. Now you look at modern America, look at modern Britain, and ask yourself where the ethical underpinning is going to come for the younger generation. Can we rely on the family anymore? Not necessarily. Can we rely on the churches anymore? Well, in some cases, but not everybody. And in any case, there are many different religious backgrounds. So the school, the public school, becomes the only place where we're developing this ethical understanding. So that's my curriculum for the 21st century, and it's a very demanding curriculum. If we say we want every child to achieve high standards, and we mean that, that is a very different thing from high standards in English and math, important though those would be. That is a very demanding bar. Even the best education system in the world, whether it's in Finland or Singapore or Alberta in Canada, they're not achieving this. But if we don't achieve this, how are we going to live on the planet that I described a few minutes ago? So this is just the beginning of the standards debate. Now, the question is, if we want to achieve that for every student, all around the world, if we want to achieve that, wouldn't the first step to be to do everywhere what we know the best systems already do? Now, I'm going to take a risk now. I'm going to quote Donald Rumsfeld. There are some known knowns about education reform, and there are some known unknowns. There are some things we know, and then there are some things we know we need to know, but we don't yet know. And I'm going to take you through 9 of the former and 5 of the latter. And out of that, I think there's an agenda that can help every child learn E brackets, K plus T plus L, close brackets. So let's start with the known knowns. These are the things that the best systems in the world are already doing. They're doing globally benchmark standards. America is finally, as a result of the new agenda, doing globally benchmark standards. That's a huge step forward. The best systems in the world are doing good transparent data. Look at Australia, look at England, look at many of the Asian systems. America is finally doing good transparent data. Some places like Tennessee and Florida are well ahead of the game, others are catching up. I think there's a really good chance, as a result of the current policies, that America will lead the world on good transparent data. The third thing's important though. You can have standards, and you can have good data, but supposing we have in our mindset a view that some children can achieve and others can't, as opposed to the good systems where they just have it as an axiom that every child can achieve. And when a child falls behind in a good system, they don't say, oh, he didn't do his homework, he doesn't like history, he doesn't like maths, his parents don't support him, no wonder he didn't learn. They don't do that. They say, how do we change what we do in the school to make sure that child meets the standard too? How do I change my lesson to make sure that child meets the standard too? Every day the teacher is saying, how do I get one more child up to the standard? Every child is on the agenda. There was a research finding in 1990, nearly 20 years ago, that if every child in the school knew that there was one adult, just one adult, who really, really cared for them, who would die in the ditch for them, who would champion them when they were in a moment of despair, if a child knew that, they would achieve higher. That made the school more effective. How many principals do you know? How many head teachers do I know in England who, in addition to looking through the students' test scores, look through and say, has that child got a mentor? Has that child got a mentor? Has that child got an adult who will champion them? And when they haven't got one, they find one. I don't know any head teacher in England who does that. But if they did do that, the performance would rise dramatically. I go back to my own teaching career again. Not necessarily with pride. There was a Peanuts cartoon a few years ago where Charlie Brown bets the children on the Monday, at the beginning of the week. He says to the children, I can teach the dog to sing by the end of the week. and they say, you won't be able to, we'll take the bet on Friday. They go back to Charlie Brown and they say, your dog can't sing, we've won the bet. And he says, no, I never said the dog would learn, I only promised to teach him. That's what I did in my classes, colleagues, in the 70s and 80s. I taught history, and some of the children learned the lesson, and some of them didn't, and then I went on to taught the next lesson. And when some children fell behind, I said, well, he doesn't really like history. He doesn't try hard enough. His family doesn't support him. They never take him to museums. We can't do that anymore. They've all got to learn. In the 20th century, we sorted children out. In the 21st century, we've got to educate every one of them. Then we come to your agenda, the agenda of this conference, a really important agenda for the United States, a really important agenda everywhere, the human capital agenda. We have to make sure that the best people, or a big proportion of the best people in a country, choose to come into teaching. Now, policymakers tend to think that that's all about pay, but if you look at your own research, if you look at the research around the world, of course pay is a factor, but there are many other things. When we had a teacher shortage in England in the late 1990s, the biggest reason for teachers leaving the teaching profession wasn't to do with pay, it wasn't to do with conditions, it wasn't to do with the behaviour of children, it was to do with poor quality school leadership. Nobody wants to work in a badly led organisation. They don't want to. So we can do lots of things about this. We've done a lot in England over this. This is one of the things I'm most proud of on behalf of my country, the reform of teacher preparation. Really good teacher preparation programs for the quality assured. Really good teacher preparation programs where the student spends 2/3 of their time in a school with a mentor and a coach, supported by the university, but not sitting in lecture halls. Really good teacher preparation where those students get paid to come to teacher preparation programs by us, by the government, because we think that's important. We pay them more if they're going to do maths and science than if they're going to do English. They don't get paid a full salary, but for a student it's a real plus to get a payment rather than adding to your student debt. So that's made a big difference, and we've had a big supply, the best 10 years of recruitment of teachers in British history in the last 10 years. Really good stuff. Advertising in cinemas and on television about how good the teaching profession is, about why it's the right place to join. We made a big effort to recruit people aged 25 to 35 into teaching because we knew that we didn't want to just supply the teachers we need from the graduates from university or high school graduates. We wanted to give people who've chosen a different career, aged 25 to 35, to say, well, hang on a minute, maybe I don't want to be a banker anymore, maybe I'd like to be a teacher. Maybe I don't want to be in media and communications, I'd like to be a teacher. Maybe accountancy is a bit too dull for me, I'd like to be a teacher. So we did that. You can train to be a teacher in England if you're 28 years old. You can get a job in a school. They will pay you a full salary. They'll train you. And at the end of that, you start to pass the same standards as anybody else. But you've been paid. You don't have to go back to college, lose a salary. You can keep paying your mortgage. You can look after your children and train to be a teacher. A quarter of all our new teachers are over the age of 25 every year now in England. When Lehman Brothers collapsed, do you remember, 15th of September, a year and a bit ago, the beginning of that financial crisis. On that day, 6,000 people lost their job in London in the Lehman Brothers headquarters. The teacher training agency, which oversees our teacher training and teacher preparation, opened retail space next door to Lehman Brothers that day. They put posters in the elevator shaft and said, why not be a teacher? 300 people came across the road and made inquiries. 25 of them joined teacher preparation programs 2 weeks later and are starting teaching this term in high schools in England. Most of them are maths and science teachers. There's lots you can do to improve the supply of people. You want people with good academic qualifications, but also the rounded personalities that make great teachers. It's not just about academic qualifications, it's about the whole package. And you have to select carefully, like the best systems do. Having got teachers into the classroom, good people, a supply of good people, you've got, as you saw on the data, a supply of good young people coming to teaching, as we have in England. The important thing is that they don't get ground down. They don't go into the classroom and think, this is 40 years of aloneness in my classroom with 30 children or 25 children. They need to be part of something. They need to be part of something where tomorrow's lesson is better than yesterday's lesson. You can't do that if you go into the classroom and shut the door. You might be brilliant. There are some brilliant people out there who can do that and do it every day and teach a brilliant lesson and inspire kids. We've all met them in our past. But you can't run a system like that. You can't get 100% of children to high standards if you do that. The teachers have to learn from each other. They have to know why that person's student work is better than theirs. How did you teach it? So there needs to be dialogue, there needs to be common planning, there needs to be mentoring, there needs to be teachers. In Shanghai, every teacher has to watch 8 other people teach every term. Yet we have rules in England, and you have here in some places, where actually, as a result of union contract, people aren't allowed to go and watch teachers teach. This is absurd. Then I mentioned leadership a few minutes ago. Leadership is really important. Take an orchestra. The conductor doesn't play a single note, does he or she? But he brings the best out of that whole orchestra. And that's what a school leader's got to do, to bring the best out of the many staff in the school. So they've got to create a climate where people want to perform well. They've got to create a climate where they expect to succeed. They've got to create a climate where there's time in the master schedule for them to learn from each other in the way that I was describing. So the school leader is an absolutely key link in this. And many systems around the world, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and England, are really focusing on improving the quality of school leaders, the supply of great people into school leadership positions. This is a very, very important thing. And America has a kind of ambiguity about the role of school leader. Is it an administrator or is it an instructional leader? Is it part of the school district or part of the school, this role? Is it somebody who's just managing the budgets and filling in the forms, or is it somebody who's creating the climate where every child is going to achieve high standards? There's a whole dilemma for you to work through here, and some places are getting it right and some places aren't. But one thing that definitely won't work, and you do see in America, is school principals, who are held to account for their results, but have virtually no autonomy for what they do. So they're being held to account for their results, but they can't change anything. They have to accept a teacher from across town because of the union contract. How can that person possibly shape the school that they're leading? So there's a whole agenda there. You're very familiar with it, and it's your agenda for the next day or so. And then there's getting the system to work effectively, the structure and organisation. Getting the centre of the reform to work well is a challenge. It's a challenge for Arne Duncan and Tony Miller. How to reform a federal department to lead a completely different kind of reform from anything that department has done before. It's a challenge for every state currently facing the Obama wave of reform, because suddenly the state leaders are being expected to do something really quite radical, but the capacity to implement is much weaker than they'd like it to be. So somebody's got to do something about that. To me, the biggest threat to the Obama reform agenda is the lack of capacity at states to implement those reforms. I know states are thinking about it. I know state leaders are conscious of it. But unless they get that capacity right, it's not going to work. And then there's the school district level and the school level. There's a whole set of things to get what Michael Fullan would call the capacity building right at every level in the system to make this work. And capacity building isn't a great slogan, it doesn't make big political headlines, but it's fundamental to making these things happen, because we all know that you can set the most beautiful agenda, make the great speeches, but if you don't have the capacity to implement, absolutely nothing happens. There was a Russian Prime Minister in the 1990s, he spent a frustrating year as Prime Minister, and when he finished he said to the people, "I tried to do better, but everything turned out as usual." We don't want to be like that. This is a seize the moment. We want to say, wow, that was fantastic. So those are the known knowns. Now, no system in the world is getting all that right. Some are doing much better than others. Singapore is pretty good at this. Finland is pretty good at this. Alberta in Canada, Ontario in Canada, they're pretty good at it. Australia is really getting its act together right now. So there are lots of examples of people beginning to get this right. This agenda is becoming known. It's more complicated in America because you've got 100,000 schools and 50 states and 14,000 school districts and one federal department and very complicated funding flows. That's the choice you made when you chose to kick the British out 200 years ago. By the way, I don't knock that choice, but here you are. So you've made your political system complicated. Now you've got to manage your way through it. All right. So those are the known knowns. We know that stuff. Everybody should be doing it. It's not easy. None of them are easy. But everybody should be doing it. What about the known unknowns? Well, here's a list. I mentioned the 21st century curriculum. We're not really sure about that. I gave you my equation. I feel positive about that. But there's a lot of detail, even if I'm right, to work through. But maybe I'm not right. Maybe the consultation in Alberta on what the educated Albertan should be like in 2025 will crack this. They're following it right now. Maybe the Australians are really thinking about Australia's place in the world as part of their national curriculum debate. Maybe they'll get it right. Anyway, there's a debate. We know we need to get it sorted out, but we haven't got it sorted out. There's a lot of very glib, shallow thinking around that in the 21st century we did knowledge and now we're going to do skills. There's this phrase, 21st century skills, which when you strip it down is about being nice to people. We've got to get better than that. So what is the 21st century curriculum? Let's be rigorous about this. I like Howard Gardner's book, Five Minds for the Future. Very insightful. Helped me with the equation that I just put up a few minutes ago. But we haven't got it right yet. Then there's the human capital model. For how long are we going to persist with the model of one teacher, one room and 25 or 30 children? Why do we think that is the solution to everything? Why couldn't we have a teacher's day where some of the time they're working one-to-one with a child who really needs to inspire, you know, that champion of the child, the person who's going to die in the ditch for that child. Some of the time they're working with a small group who need particular help. Some of the time they're teaching a class in a normal way. Some of the time they're doing a lecture to 500 people, or maybe 1,000 people using technology in 5 or 6 different schools. Why can't we begin to break up the human capital model? What is the staffing model of a school? In England, we devolve the staffing model to the principal. The principal can decide how many teachers, how many other staff, how many computers, how many books, what books. All of that is devolved to the school. So some of those people are really beginning to experiment. You can go to an English school, in some cases, and find a lesson being taught by a teacher 100 miles away. We're beginning to get onto that, but we're only just at the beginning. It's only a handful of schools out of 25,000 in England. We have to change the human capital model. It can't be right to have one teacher, one room, and 25 kids all the time, every day. That can't be the best thing to do. Then there's the whole school and out of school. You know, children, if you take 100% of a teenager's life, they spend 30% of it asleep, which is probably a good thing. They spend 10% of it in school, and they spend 60% of it somewhere else. So let's suppose we get the 10% there in school right. Suppose we get that bit right. What about the other 60%? Supposing, like in America, they're spending 3 months in the summer going backwards educationally because they're in difficult places not learning anything. How can that possibly be the best way to organise a child's year? Supposing some of that 60% is in the evening and they're hanging around in the streets being approached by dangerous people with drugs or whatever it might be. How can that be right? Supposing we did get these kids into real learning opportunities outside of school. Supposing they were able to spend their evenings either studying or doing productive things like sport or even one day watching a good television program as opposed to some of the other stuff that appears. Supposing we got all that right, how would we then connect that to the 10%? How would we make an integrated whole of the 10% and 60%? I thought about this a few years ago in the learning game actually that Paul mentioned earlier on. Supposing every school in the world was perfectly effective, so generating really high value added, absolutely fantastic, we would still have a huge equity gap. The reason we'd have a huge equity gap is there's a social capital gap. So then you say, well, what as a policymaker can you do about the social capital? I mean, you can get into kind of very dangerous territory of the state trying to intervene in everything, which you definitely don't want. So my thought was, supposing you invented a voucher, not for the school, but for the out-of-school learning. Supposing every child on a low income got, I don't know, $1,000 a year to spend on out-of-school learning. They could go to museums. They could go to, the museums are free in Washington, but they're not free everywhere. They could go to, they could go on an expedition to climb a mountain. They could go to the theatre. They could get extra English lessons. Maybe they want to learn the trombone, but the school doesn't have a trombone teacher. They could learn the trombone. So this voucher would give them the social capital that parents who have the will and the means automatically give to their children anyway. I'm not saying that's the solution, but we've got to get somewhere to connect the school and the out-of-school learning. Otherwise, however good we get the school system, we'll still have inequity. Then there's knowledge management. How can we carry on relying on each teacher working out for themselves and maybe occasionally running into somebody else who has a good idea? This is the era of Google. This is the era of rapid transfer of knowledge. But how many people have actually sorted out a system where teachers learn from each other across, for example, Chicago, or across the United States, or across the world? In Victoria, they built the Ultra Lab. the Ultranet, which is a set of connections between all the teachers in Victoria, Australia, all the parents, all the students. In New York City, they're building, with help of others, a social networking site where teachers can ask for ideas from other colleagues, but also log ideas that they think will be useful to other colleagues. And then we'll know after a while, or they'll know after a while, which teachers are providing the ideas that help many others, because it will record how many times those ideas get used. We could do so much more with knowledge management. And then there's technology. We fill our computers with schools with computers. We know the kids use technology avidly before they go to school and after they go to school, hardly at all when they're in school. We know that the main thing about the school is to ban mobile telephones during the day, which probably is necessary, but we haven't got all that worked out. So we could be using technology to do all the things, the curriculum, the human capital model, the school and out of school. Knowledge management is not a separate technology, it's technology as part of a strategy to unlock all of that. Now, supposing that we got all the 9 known knowns done and we cracked these 5 known unknowns. I don't mean we in this room now, I mean we the educators of the world. Supposing we did that, or supposing one system did it, supposing you seize this moment in America and you're the people that do the 9 known knowns and the 5 unknowns first. That will be absolutely transformative. The amount of learning potential that you would unlock would be phenomenal. If you just did the 9 known knowns really well, the rise in performance would be awesome. And if you got this stuff right as well, it would be beyond our wildest dreams. So, somebody's got to do it. Why not you? The Americans, when I'm sitting at home in London, I think about America. This is what I think about. I studied American history, so I think about it with great affection. But I sit there and I think, I want, in the 21st century, a big, strong, generous America. America can help solve the world's problems, or it can create them. It's the biggest country in terms of economic might, it's the biggest country in terms of military might. It can be the generous America that created the Marshall Plan, or that rescued and rebuilt Japan after the war. Or it can be the other kind of America. What strikes me when I look back is that at the moment when America had the biggest lead over the rest of the world in high school education, which was 1955, at least for white kids, at that point, America was at its biggest and strongest and made the biggest contribution to building the world, rebuilding the world after the war. I don't think it's a coincidence that at the point the high school lead in terms of the performance that America had over the rest of the world coincided with the moment when it was big, strong and generous. And I want that moment to come again, because that will help all of us solve the problems that I began with. So let me leave it like this. Seize the moment, and thank you very much.
We have time for just a few questions. Sir Michael's headed to Prime Minister Blair, who's giving an education presentation today in just a little bit. So are there any questions? And if there are, I need you to go to the microphones.
I have a question.
All right. I think we have 3 people, and we'll take 3 questions. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, your example of the 1926 reform, I assume it was, where you brought in unions. First of all, is that reform good or bad? I couldn't tell what you were saying. Second of all, did unions mean teacher unions? And if so, sitting back was a bad thing? Staying out of the way was a bad thing? I don't get any of the points that were mentioned.
Okay. Well, I obviously explained myself badly. The 1926 reform was the reform. I was using it to illustrate the speed of the pace of decision making, not really getting into the reform, but the reform was a report that said we've got these all-age elementary schools that run from age 5 to age 14. 14 was the school leaving age in 1926 in England. And they said, why don't we split these schools at age 11 and have a secondary department and a primary department? And eventually, the secondary department split off and became secondary schools, and then we raised the school leaving age to 15 and then 16. Was it good or bad? The National Union of Teachers, I was talking about teacher unions, the National Union of Teachers thought it was good, but my point was their response wasn't needed till 1928. The government thought it was perfectly normal to spend 2 years for a union to write a response. When I was in government in Britain, we gave people about 8 weeks to respond to a consultation. So my point was about the pace of decision making. I don't think I made a point about standing back or not. I just thought I thought the NUT was doing exactly what was expected of them, and they were very they had a very good dialogue with the government at that time. I worked for the NUT for 8 years, which is why I need a librarian.
So that was an example of how unions should behave.
No, although personally, I mean, I didn't give it as an example of how a union should behave. I gave it as an example of the pace of decision making. However, the union did behave on the Haddo report in an exemplary way. They gave a very thoughtful response 2 years later that was taken into account.
Thank you very much for your comments. I wanted to ask you one more thing. The Rumsfeld quote actually has a third part to it. And the third part is the unknown unknowns. And to finish the quote, he says, it is the unknown unknowns that trip us up every time, so to speak. We followed later a few months with the quote, the infamous quote, stuff happens. But I'm wondering if my comment on the unknown unknowns.
You know, there's a kind of theoretical problem about commenting on the unknown unknown. There was a British Prime Minister in the 50s and 60s, Harold Macmillan, who at the end of his 7 years as Prime Minister was asked why he hadn't achieved more, and he said, in that beautiful cut glass British accent that he said, events, dear boy, events. And so the unknown unknowns, you know, that the world is inherently unpredictable, and we, you know, in a few years we'll know some things that we didn't know, and if we went back 20 years, we didn't know about the internet, or I didn't anyway. So there's going to be a whole lot of stuff happening. So you can't comment on the unknown unknowns, but in terms of action now, it seems to me, you know, in the era of evidence-based policy making, working on the known knowns, working to solve the known unknowns is the best thing we can do. There will be other things that happen that may be good or may be bad that we by definition can't comment on because we don't know what they are. But having a strategy, having a plan based on the evidence seems to me the best place to start. And then as John Lennon said, life is what happens while you're busy making other plans. We have to live with that.
Okay, well, let's thank Sir Michael again for a great opening.
Thank you all for a wonderful kickoff to this morning. We're moving now into the regional team working sessions. That information should be on your agendas or your red conference personal itinerary. Also, those of you from state education agencies who've signed up to participate in the interviews, or do I need to ask them to participate? Oh, so there are folks from the University of Michigan, who's the evaluator for the TQ Center, looking for state education agency staff to interview. And those are the team of evaluators over there, along with Charlie, and they may be randomly selecting you for some exciting conversation. I think the other last point is for those of you who are not participating in a regional working session, we have a session demonstrating the use of many of the TQ Center tools and resources, and that is happening. Anybody know, have their agenda in front of them, in what room? Anyway, it's on your agenda, on both of your agendas, so we hope to see you there. Then we will be convening back in this room for lunch. Test Your EQ IQ is going to be the highlight. We don't ever want you to be bored during this conference. And from there, we'll move on to our workshops in the afternoon. So thank you again, and enjoy the day.